crazy to be back. This is my third season of Casual Disasters. I haven't recorded, I don't think, since March. This season, I have some really awesome guests coming, and I'm also having my actual logo printed on t-shirts and stickers, so I'm really excited to post those and have them. Every guest, by the way, is getting a free shirt just for being on the show. And I have Mariah McKay here today. We had planned last season to do, I think, like a couple part episode because there's so much to talk to you about. If you haven't heard that, it's on season two. And that was really cool because we first bonded over having ADHD, and I'm an educator, so we talked a lot about like the education system. So if you haven't heard that, you should go back and listen. But today we're going to get into something different. I don't know if we mentioned your co-housing and all that work, but I know we talked about Simba. And what else did we talk about? Do you remember? Does it connect to co-housing? I don't know.
There was some exploration of what makes Spokane full of unique possibilities. We have certain constraints, but with those constraints make other things possible, and we went down that path for a little bit.
Okay. Just what is that? Like, if you've never heard of it.
Wow. So co-housing is where several households, usually anywhere between 9 to 40 households, and that could be a single in a household or a whole family in a household, decide to design a custom pocket neighborhood of sorts and work together to either retrofit existing structures to fit their vision for what a shared community with private homes could look like, or they build new. Because oftentimes the kind of housing stock we have to work with does not lend itself to socializing and domestic collaboration in the way that is most desirable and popular in co-housing. So as you might imagine, there's a lot of variety in what people's imaginations come up with. You could have rural co-housing, urban co-housing, suburban, semi-urban, inner-urban in our case. You can have senior co-housing where everyone's over 65, or intergenerational co-housing, which is what we are. People design cottages that stand by themselves. People sometimes in urban co-housing are in a tower. So there's a lot of different ways people can do co-housing, but there's the central theme is designing gathering spaces and shared living spaces in addition to private, fully equipped homes where people get to know each other and can support each other in life in unique ways that are very pro-social and beneficial to people who want to live that lifestyle.
Yeah, it's like, how did you find out about it?
I was introduced to actual co-housing through my partner, Jim, who had friends in Olympia who lived in co-housing. But before that, I've had a little taste of cooperative living on our family's traveling carnival business, where all my aunts and uncles live very close together in the same neighborhood, just north of Hilliard. And a lot of the people that we worked with on the carnival would travel with us in their own trailers and then overwinter in Spokane on my grandparents' property. And we would host meals in grandma's house, a time or two a day. And so the dinner bell would ring and a dozen greasy carnies would come in from the barns and wash up, and we'd sit around the big long table, and the kids would sit in the living room because there wasn't enough room in the dining room, with little TV trays, and we'd all eat together, 20, 30 people in a relatively small, normal-sized house. And that was just how life was, and there was a real sense of camaraderie and belonging. And so by contrast, my mother's neighborhood up in Mead on North 5 Mile was really waspy and isolated. It was a like the prototype for what we see now in the McMansionville, USA kind of syndrome. And people would just act shocked and kind of horrified or even offended if you happened to knock on their door to check in or ask for a cup of sugar or something. And it was very isolating and lonely. And there was a lot of reasons we got into learning about co-housing and got the bug to want to build one in Spokane.
Yeah, are you like the only one that exists here then? That's
currently we are the only formal co-housing community in the greater Spokane area. We're hoping that will change pretty soon. There's several groups that have been inspired by our project. Most advanced among those is Cheney Co-Housing. There's a group of about a dozen would-be residents who are looking to get a beautiful parcel of 10 acres of land right on the edge of Cheney, zoned so that it could be developed for a co-housing village. But just with the bureaucracy of government, that process of getting the zone change is taking much longer than is desirable for their timeline to recruit members and get the project going.
Cheney is more difficult than Spokane was?
Just because that parcel of land is not zoned for the kind of housing that's right across the parcel line from it in the city. So it's like touching the city limit border, but it's not technically in the city. So, and Cheney has a lot of rural land around it, and so they need a zone change to have the kind of housing format that would work for co-housing allowed on that parcel.
Okay.
Whereas in Spokane, we were in an inner urban neighborhood in East Central, in the Perry District, and we were already in multifamily zoned land, so we didn't have to go through that extra step, which was a great relief because we had many other steps in the process to complete to make it happen.
Yeah. The first time, and I could be wrong, that I had ever seen co-housing was like, is it like Switzerland or like somewhere like that?
Denmark. It's okay. Very popular there. Co-housing has existed in many different Asian societies throughout history as a popular housing format. But in the West, it really was popularized and perfected in Denmark and the Netherlands and near neighboring countries. And it's spread out from there and really came to the U.S. in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, what I liked about that concept was like the care for children, like other people tapping in for families. I've had the privilege of having dinner at your co-housing, and that experience of being, I'm just thinking of a working person, having people rotate dinners. And it's not all on you every single night, like cooking the dinner, just those things to me, I was like, oh, that's so big. And a huge relief for people.
Oh, it's incredibly nourishing. I just count my lucky stars every day. It's the gift that keeps on giving. It's really changed my life. I used to be a pretty tightly wound, dare I say, slightly neurotic individual, really intense, right? I'm still intense, but I'm not as tightly wound as I used to be. And that's thanks in part to actually receiving support from other people on a regular and reliable basis, whereas you're always on your own before that. And so giving and receiving the gift of home-cooked meals and all kinds of other things that we share in co-housing definitely has a way of relaxing a person. You know, you actually have the space to ask yourself what matters in life. Whereas before, you don't have space for that. You're just, you know, okay, where's my next meal coming from? I don't have time to cook. I have to pick it up. I have to, you know, this, that, and the other. Or make huge batches and eat the same thing for 2 weeks and freeze. And just people have to come up with all kinds of shortcuts and hacks and just to make their lives fit, you know, and you're supposed to work out every day and you're supposed to, if you have kids, like how does this, like mathematically, it just doesn't fit. So our expectations and what's available to us as individual households don't always match up, but that becomes more possible and you can really get your priorities straight in co-housing where there is a lot of assistance and support and you're getting scales of efficiency from helping people out, you know, everything from yard work to maintaining buildings. It's all shared and all cooperatively managed. And we have a lot of systems for how we accomplish that. There's definitely a learning curve to living in an intentional community like that. but it's one that makes you a better person should you choose to accept the adventure.
Yeah, didn't you do like the garden for, were you part of the gardening piece?
Yes.
And yeah, and co-housing. I thought that was really cool.
Yes, lots of strategies. We have 3 acres in the Perry District, just shy of that. And because we ended up, for cost savings, building 3-story buildings instead of single-story or 2-story buildings, we have more green space because we built up instead of out. And that means we have more garden space to take care of. And we actually split our land up into 26 areas. And we have a lot of themes for the different areas. So one is a common house kitchen production farm, basically. And all the food mass grown there goes directly into the common house meal program. We have another area that is private gardens. So it's like a pea patch, like a typical community garden where you can sign up for half a bed or a full bed for a season, and everything you grow in your spot, you get to eat or dispense with how you please in your private home or to your friends, or you can donate it to the community if you want to, but also it's not expected.
That's awesome.
When we have a pollinator garden, we have a homegrown national park garden, we have a kids corner area where we just recently built a fort, and they have a little corn maze. And I mean, the gardens are, we have terrace gardens, we have orchard areas, we have just a perennial cutting garden. We have a whole area with mature vines and berry bushes. It's a lot. We have chickens, 15 chickens that a team of people care for and take turns harvesting eggs. Just 2 nights ago, Jeremy cooked shakshuka for everybody.
Wow.
And 90% of the ingredients were from our garden.
Look at that. That's amazing.
I mean, it was, I could list off the ingredients. It was amazing. And the eggs in the shakshuka were from the Haystack Heights co-housing.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I was like really impressed.
I'm impressed.
This is the peak of the season for that, right?
Yeah.
So we're not always eating that local and organic from our own backyard. Sometimes people show up and are like, do you grow all your own food? And we just laugh because that's not really tenable. That's not feasible.
No.
With the seasons and the square footage. But on a night like 2 nights ago, we're almost there, living
that
dream.
That's super cool. I just went to a harvest dinner with my friends, and that was really fun because it was like everyone bring like whatever you have from this summer, which I like that. I got to try different people's, like, whatever they were most proud of from the garden, or maybe it's stuff they're trying to get rid of, but at least it wasn't going to waste either.
That's amazing. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Which made me think the night that I went to dinner at your place, you had just gotten back from that trip to Costa Rica. And because this kind of ties into, like, that spiritual piece that we were talking about earlier, not on the podcast, but separately. Because that experience or was part of that, wasn't it? Or like, I don't know if it was for you. But I remember you presenting after dinner, both you and your husband's like experience.
We got to go to Guatemala and we learned how to cook a Chimaltenango wedding feast. So it's a soup.
So good.
With squash and tomato that has a lot of seeds blended into the sauce. So it's really high protein. And it's a really nutty flavor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really, really good.
That was a fun meal. Yeah. We get really creative with theme dinners in co-housing. And more recently we moved to a pilot project where it used to be totally voluntary if you wanted to, and it still ultimately is, but cooking a meal, being the leader on the team that creates a meal, was something that only a handful of our members were bold enough or comfortable enough to attempt to do. So we had a whole kind of crew of lead chefs, but we wanted more meals than we had lead chefs. So we invited everyone to attempt to cook a meal every 4.5 months. And so we did a trial period where everyone cooks, 2 meals over in that kind of interval. And so we had a lot of new people learning how to cook for 10, 20, 30, 40 people, where they get to determine how many people they're cooking for, and they get to determine the menu, or they could also order takeout, or they could call for a potluck, or they could invite a guest chef to be the lead for the meal and just help coordinate that person. So they weren't really lead cooks as so much as their meal organizers. And that has really encouraged an explosion in the creativity and the types of meals. Like, I think this Thursday we're having, is it Kurdish food? Yeah. Mm. So one of our friends is a professor at Whitworth and has a friend who's going to cook a Kurdish dinner. And I've never had Kurdish food, so that'll be fun to, to try out.
That?
Yeah, we'll see. So, yeah, and it's just, man, it's every night is something new, and usually there's leftovers, and my life is just made so much easier being able to cook with leftovers.
Yeah. What do you think about that, like, embarking on having your own baby and, like, the meals and the, I don't know, like, are you looking forward to that support?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I'll be a lot more sane, a lot more grounded. We have a neighbor who just gave birth a few weeks ago to a little baby boy named Bodhi. And we have neighbors every meal lined up to hold him one after the next. And there's just no end. You know, people are excited to babysit. All the kids play with each other across the age groups. They look out for each other. We have friends with a little daughter who's the youngest in her family. And we're asking her to, if she's interested in playing the role of being an older sibling to our daughter, since our daughter is going to likely be an only child.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, those connections to other kids, to have that, like, relationship like a sibling would have. That, yeah, if you only have one kid, it can feel, I've heard, like, isolating in some ways. And, yeah, just that access to other children for the social, emotional connection.
Constant informal playdate opportunities, the spaces in which they can play on the site. We created a whole sensory path that kids love. Like logs and stones and different types of...
an outdoor sensory.
Yep, yep. There's a sandbox that little kids love. They never tire of it. It's, you know.
No, kids love sand.
And yeah, there's just a lot of places to run and hide. There's a whole wild area. We have a lot of... We've really tried to emphasize native plantings. We do have one area that's just a common green. That's grass in the middle of everyone's residences that people play Frisbee on, and we watch movies there on a big screen outside.
Oh, I think I saw a post about that.
Yes. Yeah,
an outdoor movie.
Been very social and fun. And that's right outside of our common house, which is, I think it's like 3,200 square feet. And that facility has a full three-chef teaching kitchen, you know, open to the dining hall and event center where we can seat 48 inside. We have a pool table / dessert table / ping pong table. We try to get as many different uses out of the same space or the same item in co-housing as possible to make it more, you know, multimodal. And we have a lounge that's great for smaller group meetings and book clubs, and studying the Enneagram is really popular in our community.
Yeah. I'm a three.
Oh, that's cool. My husband swears I'm a four.
Is that, wait, I think I'm a three or four. Is that like the one that's like most unique or like can't, is that
thinks
four?
Thinks they're special.
I'm four then.
Yep, okay. Yes.
It's like, I'm going to have to look this up.
That's, yep, definitely.
That's funny. I think we're both
four. Yes. And so being a four, we don't want to admit that we're a four because we don't want to fit into a category. Yeah, that's a whole nother episode.
Yeah, I was like, hold on, I'm gonna check this, but I think I am a four. And it's, I just found this out taking like the online, like their, I went on their website to take it because one of the founders or people that works for them like was on Glennon Doyle's podcast, and she's like an expert in the Enneagram, and I was like, I wonder what I am. I was not expecting to get a four because I was like, they kind of sound intense.
Yep.
I was like, is that really?
Very creative people, folks who have a high tolerance for emotional discomfort, whereas those around them may not.
I'm a four.
You are a four. Dead ringer.
Yeah, I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah, I bought the book, so I really want to know more about that number.
Well, when you figure out what our growth path is, let me know, because I just want to cut to however it could be useful.
Well, that creative thing when you're saying that. But yeah, it's like the angst part that I was reading and like the...
Feeling like you're a consummate outsider always.
Yeah.
That can be a bit of a complex that could be worked through for sure.
When I was reading, I was like, this sounds really negative.
Right.
Like the first time I was reading through like the characteristics, I was like,
definitely don't want to be that one.
And I'm like, that's me.
Yeah.
Which then I have to like own it. I mean, I think a lot of that's my inner dialogue that people probably don't know. I think my friend thought I was like this other number that's super giving. And like, I was like, no, I think I'm this other one.
Yep. Yeah. Other stereotypes. And this is a bit of a tangent, or like really living in the past and having a strong sense of nostalgia and memory and kind of making sense of the present through the lens of what's come before, which I can see how I do that somewhat more than most, but I wouldn't. I'm not convinced it's a core pattern, but my husband is convinced it's my core pattern. And then there's a dynamic of comparing yourself to others, which I definitely don't relate to. But I guess I do it like almost unconsciously.
I think it comes up for me in the workplace more. Like if I'm more probably competitive, like I don't want to be seen as not like the best at my job or like where that would be comparing, you know? It's an interesting one.
Anyhow, you know, a lot of people in our co-housing community have gone on a journey with the Enneagram.
That sounds cool.
And they've really, they actually have learned about the different personality types through the lens of their neighbors that they see in action in these community settings, you know, resolving conflicts and problem solving and just, you know, everyday life together. And it's really helped people learn how to navigate each other and have more compassion for what we bring that we didn't necessarily ask for, you know, our upbringings, maybe traumatic experiences we've had in the past that make us behave a certain way when there's a question on the table. All of that is really clear and highlighted in co-housing in a way that you don't think about it, and you're not forced to navigate other people as much when you're in your own house, your own private house. But then you miss out on those developmental opportunities because then you're not thinking about how other people think of you. So you're not self-reflecting as much either. And that's kind of been a really cool thing in co-housing is when you're the one that's triggered, you're like, oh, I am that person. I am the problem here. And you have to check yourself and you have to do something different because you don't want to be that person who's holding up the process or who's annoying everybody.
That everyone's like, oh God, it's them.
Yeah. So it's a real like subtle push to get your stuff together and be better.
Sounds like being in a relationship or like group counseling too. When you're saying it, I'm like, it's like you're being reflected back to yourself because you're like seeing yourself within these other people that are like on a regular basis.
It's a very powerful experience as an adult to become more mature. There's a joke in co-housing, you know, of course that has so many benefits for children, but we like to say it's a great way to raise adults.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you think of introducing a child into that community, like, what do you feel or think about with that?
Joy.
Yeah, because I'm like, there's going to be other people who help me, like parent, and teach me things.
Yes. Yeah. The way that she'll get exposed to gardening and cooking and chores and socializing and celebrations is just so much richer than, you know, my cul-de-sac on the ragged edge of Spokane County.
You know, I can picture it.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in a similar, like, after we moved out of Perry, actually, up to the South Hill.
I got to experience a beautiful forest out in my backyard before it was mowed down by irresponsible development practices. But the social life and the cultural life that co-housing makes possible for kids in terms of organized activities and, you know, a parent taking a whole van of kids up to go skiing on the mountain, whereas if you're just a single household and your, you know, parent is working full-time, you might not get to go up to the mountain and learn how to ski, you know. In co-housing, kids learn how to bike sooner, you know, they learn how to swim sooner because parents are taking turns teaching and coaching and supporting. Whereas when you're on your own, you know, that attention bandwidth of your caregiver is pretty limited, and it might take a while to get around to learning how to ride a bike.
I was thinking of, like, in the school lens too, like the communication, like students or children getting access to more people talking.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's a big lacking thing in poverty, like access to words, like language. Like, there are thousands of words behind their peers who are, like, middle. Like, by the time they get to kindergarten, for instance, mm-hmm. They've heard thousands of words less than their peer. So I'm thinking in a co-housing setting, you're having all these people around you
conversing. A lot more exposures, a lot more novelty opportunities. We just actually babysat our friend's two kids for a night, and they had a sleepover. They actually stayed over at our house. And that is not a level of trust that you would normally achieve in a typical American suburb or housing situation, even like a high density apartment building. You're probably not going to let your neighbor have an overnight with your kid, you know,
no.
Very unusual. But in co-housing, it was normal and fun and successful. And we set up a tent in our spare room for the kids to sleep in, you know, a sister and a brother. And our houses are similar, but different. So they had a blast pointing out all the things that were similar in our two households, but also that were different in our two households. And you don't get that compare and contrast sort of parallax viewpoint when you're not going into other people's houses on a regular basis and have a relationship with them and actually spend some time there noticing your environment. And so for little kids to see that there's many different ways to live right off the bat, is very powerful. A lot of us don't really get that until we're in college and we have to deal with, you know, roommates that aren't maybe models of domestic life, you know, in the frat house or whatever it is. And so we're kind of like orphaned as to trying on different approaches to domestic dwelling. Whereas in co-housing, you can see someone whose house is really cluttered, someone else whose house is really minimal, someone who's really good at decorating, someone's really, you know, good at hosting in their home. And it all helps everyone become inspired to be a more balanced person.
Yeah.
Because you get inspiration from different people.
Yeah, you would. All of those, like, cues and, I don't know, role modeling from others. And if you're different than your parents, like, how nice that would be to see someone maybe you relate to more.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, both Jim and I were raised in divorced households. And, you know, we made it fine. Like, we're successful, stable people. But there's something missing that lasts your whole life when you don't have that modeling of an example of a long-term relationship into your older years. And so it's been really great for us to be in co-housing and to see married couples who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s and see how they keep things alive and how they honor each other and how they, you know, work together. And that's just given us more ideas for how we want to be into the future as we become new parents and then eventually as she flies the coop and we become empty nesters. You know, it's just without being close to people, you don't get to try on their hat.
Yeah. I used to say that I'd never seen like what a relationship looks like when you're like from a non-divorce perspective, like just, I don't know, a healthy, like working through conflict in a healthy way. So like I was saying this to people, like if you haven't seen it, the schema around what a healthy relationship looks like. I mean, I feel like there's more opportunity in that. Like, it doesn't just have to be your parents. Like, there's more people around for that to be modeled.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And or things you don't want to do, too. And I mean,
That's also true. And there's just a lot more opportunities for informal support. You can talk to folks about what works in their marriage and see what they're willing to share with you. And you say, I really admired how you did XYZ the other day. I've never seen that done before. That was just really heartwarming or touching. And people kind of open up around that. And maybe they'll share with you why they did it that way or where they learned to do it that way. And then you realize, yeah, I didn't have that modeling.
Yeah.
So you just don't know what you don't know until you get exposed to it, something different.
Yeah, I agree. I could talk to you about this forever, but they're already kicking us out of the library.
Oh, gosh. So, we should get an extension for the technical difficulties.
I know, I was like, tonight the library was not ready for me. But yeah, it makes me think, there's just so much about that. Like, I hope it grows in Spokane and just more access. If somebody had questions or wanted to see what it was like, how do they get in contact with you guys?
They can message us through SpokaneCohousing@gmail.com. We are on Facebook and Instagram. Reach us through our website. We can figure out when and how to arrange a tour if you have a group.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you guys do like Q&A kind of tour?
Not anymore on a regular basis, but we will do upon request as we are able.
Do you have availability right now?
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm very passionate about sharing this with folks, especially folks who are wanting to actually help build more of it in the world.
Cool.
It's a big responsibility. It takes a lot of time. It's a non-trivial process. It's important to hire knowledgeable professionals to avoid making mistakes, because there's a lot at risk. Everyone puts in money to the project prior to being able to own real estate in the project, to bootstrap the costs of development. And not every effort is successful, but once most communities get land and get professionals, they do get built. So there's a much higher success rate in building co-housing than people realize.
That's awesome. Yeah. So to wrap this up, because we have to go now, they gave me the 10-minute fingers. Now I have to download it too. Check out Mariah McKay's, her Instagram, but also social media and their website for its height. Or am I?
At Haystack Heights.
Haystack Heights. If you want more information. And yeah, I've gone in there for like different events. So it's really welcoming even for people who are like members are going there or living there. They've been super helpful. Clothes, books. I think Nikki Lockwood has donated to my students through the co-housing. So they're a great resource for Spokane too.
It's full of very kind and helpful, warm-hearted people. And people are not all bad. We get so much bad news, and thriving on crisis. And it's refreshing to live in a reality where people are looking out for each other and taking care of the basics and, have time for enjoying the flowers in their front yard or joining a book club, walking
huge.
The neighbor's dog, kids get to play ball on the lawn. It's contributed to my mental health in this day and age immeasurably.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Definitely a grounding rod for a lot of people who live there.
Amazing. All right. Well, check us out. Season 3 is coming out. Some of your people, like Paul Dillon is going to be the next guest. And yeah, anyways, just I'm excited to talk to more people in Spokane again. Just everyone doing amazing work for the community. So thank you. Because Mariah's about to give birth. I thought she'd go into labor, but she didn't. So we're good.
Next week. Yep. 7 more days and I'm overdue.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me. And then check us out on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.